This morning we introduced the particular meditation method that we're doing in this retreat. Up to now we've been content with the more general understanding of the meditation process, which is we've described as first, keep awareness in the body, and secondly, notice what happens. And when we start doing that, the first thing we notice is that awareness does not stay still. It moves around. And when awareness moves to where we don't want it to go, we call this distraction. And we think that this is a major problem and we can't meditate because we've got so much of it. But if we drop that idea and simply watch awareness and where it goes to and start to get curious about it, then things start to open up. So that's at a very general level. Then we come to being more specific about it, having a meditation method as such, a technique. In our culture, we are very much technology-oriented and very much technical-oriented, and we approach meditation as if it's some kind of technology. And of course, if you're using technology, you want the best. You don't want to muck about. Some people, it's astonishing. Come to the global center of buddhanet.net, and what do I see? Windows computers. I mean, why would you live in 19th century technology when you can just get a Mac? It just solves all your problems. It's astonishing. So it's obvious that if you're going to get the technology, you've got to get the right technology. And we approach the technology of meditation in a consumer society. And if you're going to buy a product, you want the best product. So you go to the supermarket and you head to the section of shelves on laundry powder. And obviously, if you're not satisfied with a laundry powder that simply washes white, you want one that washes whiter than white. Why would you waste your time with the others? And this same attitude penetrates into the Dharma culture and the meditation culture. So people want to find the one true technique. And of course there are people out there marketing the one true technique. Practice this technique and you get to enlightenment, practice other techniques, so sorry, you'll never get there. Because it's obviously inferior technology. And of course, this kind of marketing is almost ubiquitous in the Dharma culture, and of course all of it is complete nonsense. Obviously. It's as much nonsense as the soap powder that washes whiter than white. We take it seriously because the people doing the marketing wear nice uniforms and have exalted titles. But again, that's just marketing too. So we don't need to take it seriously. All of the modern meditation techniques are modern. I think this is the first thing to realise. All of them are products of modernity. In particular, the spreading of meditation to masses of people, we could call the mass marketing of meditation. In the Theravada world, this began in the mid-19th century as a response to British imperialism, when Theravada Buddhist countries were either occupied by the British or under imminent, in the case of Thailand, under imminent threat of being occupied by either the British or the French, in their case. In the trauma of occupation, people began to re-examine their own culture. And of course, part of that was their religion, Buddhism. And when they look at their religious texts, they see what the Buddha talks about a lot is meditation. Then they look around and they ask, well, how many people are actually doing it? And the answer was very few. So you start to get a revival of the very idea of meditation, and the most radical thing being the idea that lay people should be meditating and meditating for enlightenment. In Burma, this was sparked off in particular after the Second Anglo-Burmese War of 1851-52, thereabouts. If you're looking for a date for the beginnings of the modern meditation movement, you could do a lot worse than the Second Anglo-Burmese War. It was after this war that the defeat of the Burmese king, that the king was overthrown. A new king, Mindon, was installed. He moved the capital to Mandalay and began a revival, a Buddhist revival, that continues to this day. Mindon himself was a meditator, and the first lay meditators in modern Burma were him and members of his court. Throughout the 19th century, the lay meditation movement gradually spread. This included a study movement, a great deal of literature on meditation practice was published in Burmese in the latter part of the 19th century into the 20th. The form of meditation that they were most interested in was what they called insight meditation, vipassana bhavana, the cultivation of insight. And this is because they were quite focused on enlightenment. The predominant meditation tradition that existed was forms of meditation associated often with chanting, visualization, also meditation on breath and so on, but for the purpose of developing deconcentration states and psychic powers. And this is serenity, practices for serenity. And these reformers said, no, that's a dead end. We're heading towards insight, vipassana. So they had a different spin on it. So it was a modernizing movement. It gradually built up steam during the first half of the 20th century. In 1911, Mindon side, or also known as Jetavana side, opened up the first meditation center in Burma, designed specifically to cater for lay people as well as monks and nuns. In 1932, a young monk turned up, Venerable U Subana, turned up to practice, and he did his practice there and did very well. And Mindon thought he was pretty special and said, go forth and teach. U Subana went back to his home monastery and began to teach before World War II, before the Japanese invaded. His monastery had a big drum in the courtyard, and the drum was beaten to summon the local lay people to hear Dharma talks, or when Subana started to teach meditation, to come and meditate. Big drum in Burmese is Maha Si, and so U Subana became known as the Maha Si Sayadaw, the big drum Sayadaw. He wrote a two-volume work on the cultivation of insight, which I think the first volume was published before the Japanese arrived, and the second volume had to wait until after they left. This book is regarded as one of the great classics, modern classics, on what we call insight meditation. Written in Burmese, of course. Recently, it was the Mahasi Center wanted to spread it throughout the world, so they had it translated. It was translated into Pali. Unfortunately, still not entirely useful for us. But it is currently being translated into English. There's a long-term project centered in Hawaii in which they're working on it, and it will eventually see the light of day. After the war, Burma became independent. Independence movement was very much, the leaders of the movement were very much mixed up with the insight meditation movement. U Nu, the first and so far the only democratically elected Prime Minister of Burma, was a devout Buddhist and was a leader of this revival of Buddhism. He and a group of others invited Mahasi Sayadaw to come and be the head resident teacher at a new centre in Rangoon, which was designed to be part of or spearhead this Buddhist revival. This centre became known as the Mahasi Tatani Ekta, otherwise known as the Mahasi Centre. And so Mahasi Sayadaw became the head of a major lineage of insight meditation. When we look at insight meditation in the West, most of it comes either from his lineage, Mahasi Sayadaw, or from a contemporary of his, Ubar Khin, a layman, a lay civil servant, mostly in the West, via his disciple, S.N. Goenka. And so you have the Goenka method. So these are the two major streams of insight meditation in the West, not the only ones. So, for example, Christopher Titmus, his teacher was Ajahn Damodaro in southern Thailand. This is another lineage, completely independent. But they're the two main streams of insight meditation in the West today. And it's designed to make insight meditation available to the masses, which is a radical, even revolutionary project. And to do it, you have to have a technique. Now, in traditional Buddhism, if you're a meditation teacher, who do you teach and how do you teach? Well, you teach a very small number of people and you do it through extended conversations. You don't need a technique. But if you've got 100 people in the room and you're going to teach 100 people or 20 people, okay, this is how you meditate, you have to give them something to do. You have to give them a technique. And it has to be the same for everyone in the room. So, voila, you have meditation techniques. And they're designed for the mass industrialized production of meditators. It's a very modern approach. Also, the retreat structure. It was Ubar Khin who invented the 10-day retreat to fit in with the demands of lay people. Sometimes when people do intensive retreats, and I don't think my retreats are particularly intensive, I think they're more like summer camps. But if you do an intensive retreat, sometimes people complain about, oh, it's so intense and I'm just a layperson and how can you expect me to get up at this ridiculous hour of the morning and meditate all day and then collapse in bed at night completely out of it and get up ridiculously early again? Surely that's for monks and nuns. But of course, the monks and nuns would say, are you crazy? We don't do this. We've got 20 years, 30 years. We're not in a hurry. You are. Because you're lay people, you're busy, you've got careers, you've got families, you've got responsibilities. You don't have much time. How much struggle does it take to take a week off to meditate? It takes a lot of effort. So during that week, there's no time to lose. Time is precious. Go for it. Don't muck about. This is the basis of the intensive retreat. It's designed for lay people. It's designed for us. There's a classic line in the Buddha's in the sutras. There was a flourishing lay meditation movement at the time of the Buddha. And when you have lay practitioners who talk to the Buddha and maybe become enlightened or whatever, at the end of the discussion, there's this standard line where the layperson says goodbye, and the layperson says, and now, Venerable Sir, we must go. We are busy and have much to do. Mm. And off they go. I've never come across an instance in the suttas where, after being taught by the Buddha, a monk or a nun says, and now, Venerable Sir, we must go. We are busy and have much to do. They're not busy. They don't have much to do. Well, unless they're Venerable Panivaro, of course. because that's the... Their whole lives are devoted to this. So they stick around. They're not in a hurry. But we are. So, and we need a technique and we need to go for it. So this is where it all comes from. Now, what distinguishes Mahasi's approach to meditation is the basic structure of what he called primary object and secondary object. Yesterday, what the exercises we were doing, keep awareness in the body and notice what happens. So, keep awareness in the body, the primary object. What is my central reference point? Where do I park my awareness? Well, we do it in the body. Mahasi would say, in the sitting practice, do it in park the awareness on the breathing sensed in the lower abdomen. So, the movements, what he calls the rising and falling of the abdomen. The movements in the lower abdomen as we breathe in and out has an eerie resemblance to the Chinese yoga system of the Tan Tien, what the Japanese call the Hara, the movements down here. It's very interesting. Coincidental, I'm pretty sure Mahasi was not copying this, but very interesting that he picked the same thing to focus on. So that's the primary object. So when you sit, make this your meditation object and just follow those movements. Now, at some point, if you do this, you will be distracted. In other words, awareness will go somewhere else. What we said yesterday was, notice what happens. What Mahasi Sayadaw says is, when you notice that awareness has slipped away and gone somewhere else, then make that somewhere else your meditation object. That's the secondary object. So you have primary object, secondary object. Primary object, the job of the primary object is to sustain attention over time. So you have something to go to with the awareness and you keep it there and you study it over a period of time. And in studying it, we get to know it intimately well. So, to maintain attention over time. The secondary object is what grabs the attention from time to time. Another way of looking at it is we choose the primary object. If we take an off-the-shelf method, like Mahasi, then we're given the primary object, rising and falling of the abdomen. Or we might choose another one. But there's an element of choice here. With a secondary object, there is no choice. The awareness slips away somewhere else. I didn't choose for it to slip away. It just slipped away. And I suddenly realise I am somewhere else. The secondary object chooses me. So the primary object is fairly simple and straightforward. Life gets more complicated with the secondary object. Mahasi talks about the basic activity of noting. In Mahasi literature and Mahasi teaching, you will hear about noting the meditation object. Now, the verb to note is the translation of a Burmese verb, which I've long since forgotten, which simply means to be aware of. So to note something is to be deliberately aware of something. Now, I can be aware of something, but not deliberately aware of it. So I can be sitting here aware of the fact that there's sound in the background. I'm noticing sound in the background, but I'm not noting it. Or I could stop and listen. A number of different birds from far away, not particularly noisy. So if I'm noting, I'm deliberately aware of. The work in meditation is noting, to be deliberately aware of something. And so this something is at the centre of one's attention. Attention is always structured in a particular way. If I focus on something or note something or am deliberately aware of something, that becomes is at the centre of my field of awareness, while around it other things are happening. So let's say visual awareness. If I look at Brian, so Brian's at the centre of my visual field and I'm studying him very closely, so he's not going to get away with anything. But around him, I can see other things. I can see the floor, I can see the people, I can see the wall, I can see the window at the back, I can see the ceiling. Centre, periphery. Now, the fact that I can see the periphery is not distraction. But I notice that someone just moved, I've got to see what it is. So now Christine is at the centre of my visual field. I can still see Brian, but he's now on the periphery. Centre, periphery. Switch back. Centre, periphery. It's always centre, periphery. Always. That's the structure of attention. So in noting, I choose my centre. This I will focus on. Not that. This. And that is the central action of noting. But there will always not always, usually be something around it that I'm aware of as well, which I would notice. So I would note Christine, but notice Brian and other people. I would note the window, but notice the sound of the bird. So when we're talking about distraction, distraction is not the fact that something else is happening. That's not distraction. That's noticing the field, noticing the periphery. So if I'm following the breathing, let's say, and at the same time there's thought going on, or there's sound, or there's pain in the body, that's not necessarily distraction. Distraction is when I realise I'm completely caught up in the thinking and I've forgotten the breathing. That's distraction. So the centre has shifted from the breathing to the thinking. And the breathing is either in the background or it's disappeared. That is distraction, because the centre has moved. So that distraction becomes the secondary object. So as soon as I recognise, oh, I'm caught up in X, then X becomes my meditation object. And I focus on it. And I study it with the same energy that I study the breathing. And then at some point I will choose to come back to the primary object. But that's a deliberate choice. So I have primary object, secondary object. Come back to primary object, secondary object. Come back to primary object, secondary object. Come back, boom, 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 boom. This is the basic structure of the practice. It entails movement. So there's primary object, secondary object. There's noting. There's noticing, and also there is naming. Now, when I note a meditation object or note any experience, one way of helping that is to name the experience. So if I'm listening to the birds, I could name it. I could name it hearing, or I could name it birds. There's a slight difference between the two of them. Can you tell what the difference would be?
One's a verb and one's a noun.
Mm-hmm. But the activities, what's the difference between the two activities? If I name hearing, or if I name birds, what would be the difference?
One's your sensory perception of what you're hearing, the other is outside, putting it outside. To
yeah, that's it. If I name hearing, I'm naming what's happening here at the ear sensitivity. If I name bird, I'm naming what's happening out there. So sense sensitivity, sense object. Now, that's actually pretty precise, isn't it? More precise than our normal sense of hearing. That, and naming stimulates precision. Naming is about aim. I'm being aware of this, not that just over there, but this. So the naming is about aim, about precision. We name in order to send awareness to precisely this. So with primary object in the sitting, classically the Mahasi would say we name the primary object as we breathe in, we would say rising, as we breathe out, falling, rising, falling, rising, falling. So we name the movements. And this is being deliberately precise. This is the rising movement. It's not the falling movement. It's the rising movement. The rising movement just ended. Now it's the falling movement. So precision. It doesn't really matter what you name it. You could name it in, out, up, down, or whatever. But the important thing about the naming is to aim, to direct awareness to where you want it to go. So we note, and this noting may or may not be accompanied by a name. The naming is very useful because it stimulates aim. It's like a finger pointed to what we are aware of. But it's not absolutely necessary. It's very useful, especially in the beginning. And it's very useful also if you come across a situation which you're not quite familiar with, you're not quite sure what's going on, then naming it can really clarify what the situation is. Any questions so far? Is this making sense? Yeah, question.
That's very good, Patrick, that you said that naming isn't sort of compulsory, because at one point I got into the situation where I was sort of labelling everything as being an impediment in itself.
Yeah, it's a common mistake, and it's partly that English verb to note, which in English sounds like, you know, to make a mental note, to write something down. I was told by a translator of one of the sayadaws that when Mahasi published his book back in the 40s, he used a term to be aware of in Burmese, which got, for some reason or other, it got translated as the verb to note into English. But of course, he also talked about naming. And apparently, under the influence of the Mahasi method, that verb has now changed its meaning in everyday Burmese, and it now means to be aware of with a name. It's funny how concepts get in the way. If there's too much naming, the practice turns into a mantra, and the mantra gets in the way. So it's the classic story of the finger pointing to the moon. You don't look at the finger, you look at the moon. If you find yourself looking at the finger, drop it. So if you're using the naming and the naming is getting in the way, drop it. That's the best thing you can do. Just get rid of it. Just drop it completely. Any other questions? Yeah.
When you were talking before about focusing on a particular thing and then also being aware of the periphery, I was wondering if you could comment on that in terms of samadhi. So let's say you're doing walking meditation, and you're completely aware of just the feet, really nothing else.
Mm.
Is that not what we're looking for?
No. That's why I said that's the general structure of attention. But what happens with samadhi? Samadhi essentially means unification. It's usually translated concentration. I think that's misleading because for us that can mean, oh, I must be focusing narrowly upon a very small something. Whereas the object of samadhi might be very big. But when samadhi develops, as you were saying, like it could be in the walking, it's not that you're necessarily much more intensely focused in on the feet, it's that you start to forget everything else. You start to forget the periphery. So you could either say you forget the periphery, or you could say that the primary object starts to expand and fills up the whole space. It's like it can appear in different ways. So that you do have, I was talking about the general structure of attention, but that structure will change given conditions. This is part of dependent arising. Nothing is absolute. So as samadhi develops, the mind and the heart become more unified, and then the field will become more unified, and the making of a distinction between centre and periphery will become artificial. And it's more like, boom, that's the whole package. And it could be a big package, or it could be a small package. It doesn't really matter. It's the same with primary and secondary object. At a certain, that when Mahasi talks about that, he's talking about it essentially at the early stages of the practice. Now, this could be for a raw beginner, or it could be for a very experienced meditator just beginning a sitting period before you really develop samadhi. But at a certain point in the practice, that distinction between primary and secondary just dissolves. It no longer becomes meaningful. It's just the object is whatever it is. So Mahasi actually defines insight meditation as to note whatever arises in any of the six sense fields as it arises. So the entire universe is the meditation object. But that's in a more mature phase. When he's talking about technique and he's presenting the technique, then he'll talk about primary object, secondary object. Yeah.
Just talking about primary object and secondary object, the primary object is to focus on the breathing, then, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I understood you to say that when secondary objects arise, you follow them and see where they go. Did you say that, or did I misinterpret?
I didn't say you follow them, I said you note them. Well, I hope I said you note them. Maybe I didn't. So when the secondary, you're noting the primary object, and then when the secondary object arises, you note that with the same energy, the same commitment as you note the primary object. Now, is this the same as following them wherever they go?
Yes.
No.
No?
I don't think
Why
so.
Why not? What's the difference?
You notice things about them in some places you don't want to go.
So there's a degree of choice involved.
Well, yeah.
It's like you're not being dragged along by them.
Well, you could be, but that would be a choice.
But you're out.
Oh, surrender.
It's more like you're examining it.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you talk about following it, there's even an implication of being dragged along by it, which is the experience of distraction. Mm. When I'm distracted, I'm being dragged along. But if I stop and turn my awareness to the distraction, the relationship to it immediately changes. And it's not exactly that I'm in charge, but I am more actively engaged with it. And my interest, my intention is to study it, to get to know it. And that relationship changes the distraction.
So does it mean that we don't need to always come back to our primary object? So that's not the aim?
In the early stages, yes. But later on, no. There's no one right answer for that. Primary object, one of the major things that the primary object does is develop serenity, samadhi. So if you start doing this approach and you don't come back to the primary object, you'll probably develop very good awareness and very good mindfulness, but you won't develop much samadhi. So you won't penetrate beneath the surface. You'll be stuck at a surface level.
So that means we can change our primary object for the time. At the beginning, our primary object will be maybe our breathing, our stomach. And then maybe something arises, then we change our way of approach, so something arises, the secondary can become the next primary.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to come back to the original primary. We can just use the second object as the primary object. And then maybe the third object arises when we are securing the second. Then we can go to the third. So that will be the next step.
That's possible. But I wouldn't do it early on, because then it just gets incredibly confusing. What you want is a central reference point. If you start there, you end there, you come back there, you're at home there, if you're in any doubt what to do, you go there. So you train yourself to have a home base, the primary object. So you head off to the secondary object, you study it. When you're done with it, when it's no longer grabbing you. Remember, the primary object is what grabs the attention and pulls you away. When it's no longer grabbing you, you come back home to the primary object. Now, if you do that over a period of time, you will become so at home that you can be at home anywhere. So that's when primary-secondary distinction starts to dissolve. So what used to be a secondary object can now be a primary object. But that will happen naturally. Don't try to make it happen, but it will happen at a certain time. And when it happens, that's fine. Yeah, Brian.
With the primary object and the concentration that comes with it, of the application, I found as the verse quietens, there is more precision going on. And some investigation.
Yep.
But when the mind wanders to the secondary object, and we note that, do we note the... And you say, look at the secondary object. and we find that we think, oh, we should be coming back to the primary,
mm-hmm.
or do we go on with this investigation we're talking about?
Mm. This is a
how far, do we note that it's memory, fantasy, or planning,
mm-hmm.
and then how does it come about
mm-hmm.
to be this
mm-hmm.
these different areas, whether it's anger, you know, could be anger, could be delusion, could be
mm-hmm.
selfishness or something. So how far do we go with this investigation?
Yeah. This is a classic question, and it's why are you sorry? What a relief. Somebody asked it.
He has an answer.
The difficulty is not the question, but the answer. Because there's no one right answer.
Mm.
There's no package.
No.
When you note the secondary object, you note you're distracted, and then you turn attention to it. Let's use thought as an example, because that's one of the classic distractions. Has anybody ever been distracted by thought? often what will happen, as soon as you notice the thought, it'll dissolve.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing to stick around for,
mm-hmm.
except the aftertaste.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it does leave an aftertaste.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a feel for the wandering mind and what it feels like. So you might stick around for a bit, like a second or two, just to get a taste of that. And then you come back. So you wouldn't spend much time there because you note it and it dissolves.
Mm.
But sometimes you note a secondary object and it does not dissolve.
Mm.
For example, emotion. Now, emotion is much more stable than thought. So I might find myself thinking irritable thoughts about someone, and then realize, oh, I'm pissed off. I'm irritable. And that so I note the thinking, it goes, but then it will pop up again. It might be about the same person, it might be about someone else or something else.
Mm.
So I realize, oh, what's going on is irritability. I'm irritated. Mm. So then that emotion becomes the meditation object, the secondary object. Now that is, in its nature, tends to be more stable. It'll stick around longer. So, as long as it's grabbing my attention, I'll stay with it, and then I'll come back. So, it depends on how quickly the object dissolves. It'll depend on the behaviour of the secondary object, and it will depend on your relationship to it. The two secondary objects will take you off. To me, basically of two types. One is your obstacles, what we're calling here distraction, the things that get in the way. I'm trying to meditate, I'm trying to be peaceful and still, but I can't do it because ... Now these are the obstacles. I have to work with these obstacles. I have to get to know them. They have to be my meditation object, because if I don't get to know them, they'll just block me forever. So I work with them. I have to. So as long as something is bugging me, getting in the way, for as long as that is going on, I work with it. Not necessarily all the time, but I keep coming back to it, to work with it, to get to know it, what's going on. The other area is what interests me. So I might find myself, something pops up and I become really interested by it, I'm really fascinated by it. What? How does this work? What's all this about? So in my case, I was particularly bugged by thinking. As you probably worked out, I'm an egghead. And I think a lot. And I'm attached to my thinking. So when I, for a long time, I was really struggling with thought in the meditation practice. And kind of, I'd meditate and I'd have this big hammer and I'd just smash it every time it raised its ugly head. And so I come spinning out of the meditation practice completely exhausted, totally spun out, until finally I started to use thinking as a meditation object, and I became really interested in it. Like, What drives me to think? Why is it attractive? Why is even the boring thoughts attractive? Why is it that when I realize I'm in the middle of the thought, I feel I have to finish it off, even though I know exactly how it's going to end? Isn't that odd? Curiosity. So I got interested in it. So if I'm interested in something, I'm learning something, I'm learning about the nature of the mind, about what it does, how it weaves its magic spells. Mm. And from that, insight can arise, and also samadhi can develop, because I'm interested. And so I'm there with it. And then come back to the primary object. So there's no single answer to that, because what we're talking about is something which is inherently dynamic and alive. Mm. The problem with technique is that it can be done very mechanically, in a very deadening way. And it just doesn't... We can get some good concentration with it, but we can't really develop much insight with it, because we're just reproducing somebody's instructions. But if it's alive, it's much more valuable. But at the same time, I'm thrown back on my own resources. I have to decide. I've got to take responsibility. Now, does it work for me to stay with the secondary object longer, or this particular secondary object, or does it work to drop it and come back to the primary? The only person who can answer that question is me.
I guess I was looking at it too as a process of uprooting defilements.
So, study defilements.
Okay, and so as they arise, these defilements, I guess we all have, like it stacks. Or only 10, really. and looking at it, and looking at this process from the secondary object point of view, and looking at why it's going on, there is a defilement going on. And making use of this thinking for that reason, that purpose. And not escaping to the back to the primary object without a bit of practice, like you know yourself, standing the primary object, the precision is very can become quite concentrated.
Yeah.
But doesn't seem to be of any use.
And you can also get the same concentration with the mind as a meditation object, because that's what you're talking about. You're talking about using the mind as a meditation object. You can get the same precision with the mind. It's a trickier object to work with than the body. Body is simple to work with. Mind is much more tricky. But you can get the same concentration with the mind. The other aspect to think about is that different teachers have different emphases, even within the Mahasi approach itself. So, for example, Sayadaw Upandita strongly emphasizes the primary object. So he'll, you know, okay, you know what the secondary object is, now get back to that primary object. And write me an essay. Very concentration-oriented. That's his approach. That's his tendency. Sayadaw Ujjanika is, look, you visited the primary object, you know what it is. Don't bore me with more tales about it. What's happening with the secondary object? Very different approach, but the same structure. Different personality, different approach. So you make it your own. This is the thing about this Mahasi structure, is that we do make almost anything out of it. Meditation is a creative activity. If you've got 20 people in a room, all doing the same meditation technique, you've got 20 different things going on. That's the nature of the meditation.
Yes, like there's as many religions as there are minds.
There are certainly as many meditation techniques as there are meditators. At least as many, if not more.
Can I just ask a bit more about, say, when thinking arises, or the secondary object arises, but particularly thinking, say, that when to explore how the thinking arises, where it's located, what's the quality, that sort of probing into, it's just like pulling it apart, versus identifying, say, the emotion beneath it and, you know, moving into something that in some ways can take you more into story, but seeing patterns and whatever. And, you know, the, so when I'm particularly, say, on retreat, then, and so often often thought, is it more useful to try to, it seems like the insight concept, if you like, following the patterns can sometimes, you can get those ahas and they can be quite big, but in the relentless grind of the thinking, is it useful to try to, you know, dissect it, if you like, into sensations or how it's arising?
Yeah, it is. As a rough rule, in insight meditation, we're not interested in the content. The content is just the background. What we're interested in is the process. Normally, we're lost in content. That's our normal relationship to thinking. Here, we're taking a step back from content and looking at the way it flows, the way it moves. What stimulates it? Where is it? How is it? What is its flavour? And so on, and so on. Sometimes, as a result, people will have insights, in inverted commas, about the content. One of the great dangers of insight meditation, in particular, is the temptation to use a meditation retreat in order to work through our problems. When I was a Zen student with Robert Aitken Roshi, he was very good on that. He had this little saying, do not use the retreat to work things through. Things will be worked through, but do not use the retreat to work things through. So a lot of that, at the content level, things will work themselves through quite spontaneously. In other words, the mind has a capacity to heal itself. So you don't have to worry about it. Don't have to go there. Rather, stay with the process. That's where the work is, and that's where you go deeper and deeper and start to uncover these patterns. But we'll be doing more on thinking later in the retreat. We'll do a morning workshop on thought, so get more detail on it. The other major form of distraction is, of course, physical pain. And in physical pain, it's much simpler. You go into the sensation and start to study it. Like, why do I think this is pain? What is it about it that tells me this is pain? So study the sensation and study the response to the sensation, what's going on in the mind. If there's pain, there's physical sensation. And we're talking physical pain. There's physical sensation and there is aversion. I don't like this. This shouldn't be happening to me. And that aversion is not in the sensation. It's in the mind. The two of them come together and we have pain. So when you're dealing with painful sensation, examine the sensation itself, but also look at the response to it. Am I resisting it? Am I fighting it? Am I the victim here? Etc. And look at how the mind is dealing with the pain, and relax your way into the whole process. Any other questions? I'll just check my notes to see I haven't forgotten anything important. We have three modalities of practice in this retreat: sitting, walking, and daily activities. Sitting, primary object is the breathing sensed in the abdomen, the rising and falling of the abdomen. If you can't find these movements, then just ask yourself, where do I find the movements? And go there. So if you can't find the movements in the abdomen, you find them somewhere else. So go wherever it's clearest and most obvious. Primary object, rising and falling of the abdomen. Secondary object, everything else. Then we have the walking meditation. Now, in the sitting meditation, you notice that the two things we're working with essentially are movement and touch. Movement, the movement of the rising and falling, and touch is tactile sensation. In walking, movement and touch. So in the walking, in the formal walking, we have a real or imaginary walking path. I'll just use this section here to demonstrate it. Always start with the standing, as we've been talking about. Construct the standing quite carefully. And then you can have the hands simply hanging by the side, have them in front, have them behind, have them in pockets, whatever. These days I tend to have them hanging by the side. And then you start to walk, and you just start to walk at about normal pace. And the meditation object is movement of touch, movement of the body as it cruises along, and touch, in particular, the impact of the feet on the ground. And you can note it as, or you can name it as walking. Walking, it's quite general, cruising up and down. You come to the end of your track, stopping, standing, turning, walking, and just walking normally. If once you get into it, you may want to start to slow down. Usually when you see people doing formal walking meditation, you see them walking quite slowly, and often you get the rhetoric of slow down, be mindful, as if mindfulness equals speed, which obviously it does not. What the slow walking will give you is stronger samadhi. When you concentration, unification, when you sit, the body is still, and the stillness of the body helps the mind become still. It's an aid to samadhi. When you walk, the slower you walk, the easier it is to develop samadhi. And precision in the awareness. Now, both of these help stimulate mindfulness, but they are not mindfulness. You can be mindful without being slow. You can be slow and not mindful at all. That is really easy. So don't slow down. Allow yourself to slow down, but don't slow down. Don't try to go slow. If you try to go slow, you are straining, and you'll get incredibly uptight, and you won't like walking meditation, which is a very sad thing. But you allow yourself to slow down. So if you find yourself starting to slow, then you start progressively being more precise with the awareness and more focused down toward the feet. And so you might start to name each step. Right. Left. Right. Left. And then as you continue, you might divide each step into two. Lifting, placing. Lift, place. Then you get to the classic Mahasi three-step. Lifting, moving, placing. Lift, move, place. You could make it into four. Lift, move, place, touch as the weight comes on the foot, lift, etc. And you can get slower and slower and more precise. So, but you don't push it. You allow it to happen, and you become increasingly precise with it. You can also do fast walking meditation. Fast walking is very good for waking up. It's good after meals. Sometimes you find, particularly like it's a confined atmosphere, in a retreat, lots of stillness, not much entertainment. Sometimes you get stir crazy, claustrophobic. You need to break out. Fast walking is great for that. When it's fast walking, you have a much longer track, and you just chant up and down the track, and the awareness goes wide. So it's the whole body. You don't try to be precise with the fast walking. So vary it. If you want to walk fast, walk fast. This side of the house is fine for fast walking. Also out there on the other side, there's plenty of space for fast walking. And again, charging up and down. So vary it. Play with it. If you you find as you settle, as the mind and the body settles, you will naturally start to slow down. So just let it happen. When you are doing the slow walking, you're particularly focused on the ground. Now what this does in part is it brings energy down. It's a very grounding activity. When you sit a lot, the energy in the body, the prana or the chi, gets stronger and stronger, and it rises up, and people often have upper body disturbances when they sit. Headaches, stiffness in the shoulders, aches, sometimes shaking, and so on and so forth. So it's necessary to bring the energy down. And one of the things that walking meditation does is it brings the energy down. It's the emphasis on that contact on the ground. Now, if you're doing a slow walking meditation and you're obsessively staying on the ground, you can get into trouble. So I'll just demonstrate what I mean. This is will be an example of very poor walking meditation. I just want you to spot the mistake. See what I'm doing wrong?
Stiff
as a board. And barely breathing.
Not
really. Because I'm so focused. I've got to be aware of these things. So, if you're doing the slow walking, you use the whole body when you walk. When we walk naturally, it's like the arms are swinging and the whole body is moving, then bring that into the walking. So I step out with the right foot and lean into the right shoulder. Step out with the left foot and lean in with the left shoulder. So the whole body is walking. And I also find that the breathing will be much better as well. So the awareness is going down to the contact, but it's going through the whole body. It's very easy if I'm focused on the feet to have the awareness down here and to cut off from the rest of the body. Don't do that. Recipe for disaster. Instead, it's like you're looking down through the body all the way to the ground. So it's dance. Walking meditation is the Theravada equivalent of Tai Chi. One of the signs of a good meditator, of someone who's really into it in a retreat, is gracefulness. You just start to move with grace, with ease, because if you're mindful of body, that will naturally tend to happen. You know, someone who's not mindful, it's got clunk, clunk, and you really get really sensitive to it in a retreat. But the people who are mindful, it's like they're gliding through the day, particularly when there's crowds, like at meals. It's gliding around people. So graceful movement is very important, and it's part of the mindfulness of the body. Any other questions about the walking? Yeah.
If you had a long day and you're walking meditation and you're having difficulty concentrating, like thoughts are going, like you're going left to right, but you're going step, but really, even that's out of filter. It's not matching the actual movement. Is it permissible to use, I think once upon a time I used the with one step, using Budo as a...
Oh, yeah.
You know, just to get that, to cut all the excessive thoughts out.
Yeah, this is one particular style of walking meditation. There's many different ways of doing walking. Some people, for example, like to tune the breathing with the steps. It's never worked for me, but I've always had problems with breathing. But yes, you could. Mantra is good for cutting through thought. It's the same in sitting as well. Sometimes if there's too much thinking, then using a mantra, it occupies the thinking part of the mind and it can help to settle you down. I would use, when I start, I'd use Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddho. And then that becomes too long and I go into Namo Buddhaya as my mantra. You play with it. You start to use combinations. But if I was in that situation, I would not be doing slow walking. I'd be doing faster walking as well.
I just want to throw in an idea I kind of got from a different teacher, which would work with walking or sitting, although I'm not sitting in a group, and that's naming out loud.
Mm.
When you're in true confusion or really exhausted, something, you know, you just cannot get yourself organized and focused, it's quite grounding to name what's going on out loud.
Mm.
And you don't have to do it for long. It just reminds you where you are. And I think, you know, if you're really fighting with your thoughts, you know, to say out loud, left, right, I mean, pretty quickly it pulls you together again.
Mm. That sounds interesting. Sounds like a variation of the mantra.
Sorry, what?
A variation of the mantra.
It's
but using voice.
What it is, yeah, yeah. Just connecting it all the way out.
Yeah. Because it's... one of the things about sound is that it uses the whole body.
Yeah. Breath and everything.
Everything. So it is quite powerful. And it's something that we've lost sight of in an oral tradition like the Buddha's. They would be much more aware of that.
Mm. It's easy to get so heady that you just cannot pull that kite back down to the ground.
Yeah, that because one of the things about concentration, certainly one of the problems that I've had for a long time, is that the very concept of concentration for me was something up here.
Mm-hmm.
And I would find that I'd be concentrating, inverted commas, say on the breathing, from here,
mm-hmm.
which is completely ridiculous because I'm not breathing up here. It's in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So getting into the body is really, really important. And in our culture, we have to work on it because we tend to be pretty much disembodied. The third aspect of the practice is the daily activities. Daily activity is everything that we do in between the formal sitting and the formal walking. Because we're coming to it last, it's easy to assume that this is the dustbin. And this is where we kind of... It's kind of, everything else. It's the et cetera of the practice. Mm. It's actually the most important section. The sitting and the walking help prepare us for the daily activity. That's the most important part of the practice. And the daily activity is just doing what we are doing with awareness, knowing what we are doing as we are doing it, which means coming back to the body, coming back to the mind. What is the body doing now? What is the mind doing now? The body's always doing something. It's always moving. It's always touching. What's happening now? What is the mind doing now? It's always moving. It's always active. What is it doing now? This is the most important part of the practice. This is what we take when we go back home.
Mm-hmm.
Not the sitting and the walking. So pay attention to that. As you cruise through the day, don't be in a hurry and be graceful in your movements. Imagine yourself dancing through the day. Be smooth in the movements. Watch the body, watch the mind. Keep, and which means Keep noticing when you forget. Again and again and again, you will notice that you've been lost in space, and in that moment, you have no idea what the body is doing. So come back to the body and find out. Get into that habit. When you wake up, oh God, where was I over the past 5 minutes? Immediately check, where's the body now? And then bring it back into balance, because you probably find it's out of balance. It's one of the reasons why we do this, the balancing and the posture and flexibility in the morning. Become sensitive to imbalance and come back into balance. And do that during the day. And same with the mind. You get a sense of when the mind is out of balance. Notice it and come back to the center. Come back into balance. You lose it again. But as soon as you notice that you've lost it, that noticing is mindfulness. And come back. Any questions or comments? This is very good. There's either total bamboozlement or total enlightenment. One or the other. And both of them are wonderful states. Okay, that's enough for today. Thank you.